Knowing it well.
Knowing it well.
Dhritarashtram.
Dhritarashtram.
Unto Dhritarashtra.
Unto Dhritarashtra.
Abhashyata.
Abhashyata.
Said.
Said.
Rajan.
Rajan.
O king.
O king.
Yagamyatam.
Yagamyatam.
Please get out immediately.
Please get out immediately.
Shigram.
Shigram.
Without the least delay.
Without the least delay.
Pasha.
Pasha.
Just see.
Just see.
Idam.
Idam.
This.
This.
Bhayam.
Bhayam.
Fear.
Fear.
Agatam.
Agatam.
Already arrived.
Already arrived.
Translation. Mahamavidura knew all this, and therefore he addressed Dhritarashtra saying, my dear king, please get out of here immediately. Do not delay. Just see how fear has overtaken you. Responsibly, Mahatma Vidura knew all this.
Mahatma Vidura knew all this.
And therefore he addressed Dhritarashtra.
And therefore he addressed Dhritarashtra.
Saying,
my dear king.
My dear king. Please get out of here immediately.
Please get out of here immediately.
Do not delay.
Do not delay.
Just see how fear.
Just see how fear.
Has overtaken you.
Has overtaken you.
Report by Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah.
Cruel death cares for none, be he Dhritarashtra or even Maharaj Yudhisthira. Therefore, spiritual instruction as was given to old Dhritarashtra was equally applicable to younger Maharaj Yudhisthira. As a matter of fact, everyone in the royal palace, including the king, his brothers and mother, was raptly attending the lectures. But it was known to Vidura that his instructions were equally meant for Dhritarashtra, who was too materialistic. Were especially meant for Dhritarashtra, who was too materialistic. The word Rajan is especially addressed to Dhritarashtra significantly. Dhritarashtra was the eldest son of his father, and therefore, according to law, he was to be installed on the throne of Hastinapur. But because he was blind from birth, he was disqualified from his rightful claim. But he could not forget the bereavement, and his disappointment was somewhat compensated after the death of Pandu, his younger brother. His younger brother left behind him some minor children, and Dhritarashtra became the natural guardian of them. But at heart, he wanted to become the factual king and hand the kingdom over to his own sons, headed by Duryodhana. With all these imperial ambitions, Dhritarashtra wanted to become a king. And he contrived all sorts of intrigues in consultation with his brother-in-law, Shakuni. But everything failed by the will of the Lord. At the last stage, even after losing everything, men and money, he wanted to remain as king, being the eldest uncle of Maharaj Yudhisthira. Maharaj Yudhisthira, as a matter of duty, maintained Dhritarashtra in royal honor. And Dhritarashtra was happily passing away his numbered days in the illusion of being a king or the royal uncle of King Yudhisthira. Vidura, as a saint, as the duty-bound affectionate younger brother of Dhritarashtra, wanted to awaken Dhritarashtra from the slumber of disease and old age. Vidura, therefore, sarcastically addressed Dhritarashtra as the king, which he was actually not. Everyone is the servant of eternal time, and therefore no one can be king in this material world. King means the person who can order. The celebrated English king wanted to order time and tide, but the time and tide refused to obey his order. I don't know which celebrated English king that was. Does anyone know? I guess he's not so celebrated. Therefore, one is a false king in the material. I think Geoffrey Chaucer originally wrote that, the time and tide wait for no one. Therefore, one is a false king in the material world. And Dhritarashtra was particularly reminded of this false position and of the factual, fearful happenings which had already approached him at that time. Vidura asked him to get out immediately if he wanted to be saved from the fearful situation which was approaching him fast. He did not ask Maharaj Yudhisthira in that way because He knew that a king like Maharaj Yudhisthira is aware of all the fearful situations of this flimsy world and would take care of himself in due course, even though Vidura might not be present at that time. Translation again by Srila Prabhupada. Mahatma Vidura knew all this, and therefore he addressed Dhritarashtra saying, "My dear king, please get out of here immediately. Do not delay. Just see how fear has overtaken you." Narayanam namaste chandanam shaivam narottaram devim sasatim yasasato jaya mudiraya nastapraya shravadresham tim bhagavati sevaya bhagavati tamashlokir bhuktir bhavati naishtiki. This indicates that renunciation is respected in this part of the world anyway, or at least it was. Even though Dhritarashtra was not the king, he was advised by Vidura, his younger brother, who was an incarnation of Yamaraj, to renounce his royal situation being maintained by Yudhisthira and get out of the palace. Prabhupada often cites the renunciation of King Bharat. King Bharat was one of the original kings whose name was used to call India Bharatvarsha. And he renounced his kingdom when he was only 24 years old, renounced the kingdom, which was full of wealth and riches and beautiful wives, queens, nice food, nice entertainment, the best of everything. At the age of 24, he renounced the whole thing, went out into the forest, and just gave up all his royal pleasures. This was very much respected. Nowadays, people like to enjoy life right up until the end of life. They live in big palaces, and they like to become kings and so on. But the saintly younger brother Vidura advised Dhritarashtra that it was time to give all these things up because he was living in great fear. As Krishnadas Kaviraj writes in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, getting aged is very painful, very fearful. He was writing about how he had so many diseases and how he was trembling and somehow he was continuing his service. So it is a very fearful situation. But one can overcome this fear when one renounces everything and lives as a mendicant in the forest, knowing that Krishna is going to take care of me, that I can be surrounded by the fallible soldiers of my wives and my parents, my children, my cousins and my brothers and sisters. But that is looked down upon by Vaishnavas. Vaishnavas appreciate renunciation, that things can be given up. Especially in old age, one is advised to give up the niceties of living a very comfortable and enjoyable kingly life. Actually, the person who is regarded as very saintly and very kingly is ending up in a very abominable situation, as sometimes stool when they're eaten by the birds, the vultures, as earth when they're buried in the ground, they end up as earth, and as ash when they're burned, which some people burn bodies. It's also mentioned that that a person doesn't actually own his own body. It's actually owned by his parents, his employer, and the worms in the ground. Because that's how the body always ends up as earth. And it's owned by the parents and by the employer. There's no exact freedom, as we call it, in the material world. So, as Prabhupada mentions, Vidura is addressing Dhritarashtra sarcastically as king, although he wasn't the king. But he was living like the king. He was living in the palace. He was maintained by Yudhisthira, his in-charge younger nephew. And he was enjoying, although the fearful situation had arisen, he was sort of warned about the imminent death because of because of his old age and sickness and agedness. But he was very materialistic, even though he was, by the law of primogeniture, supposed to be the king. Because he was born blind, he wasn't able to be the king. But he lived like a king. He lived in a royal palace, and he was maintained in a royal way. So the saintly younger brother advised him, as he would advise all Vaishnavas, to give up this way of life. And as Prabhupada says in the purport, that all of the members of the palace were very much entranced and lured by the teachings of Vidura. He wasn't an ordinary person. But Vidura didn't address Yudhisthira in the same way, because Yudhisthira was a saintly king. He was a Raja Rishi. He was not an ordinary person. And he knew that at some point he would have to, as he did later on, have to renounce his kingdom and give up life. So he didn't address him in the same way, but he knew Dhritarashtra was very materialistic, so he addressed him in a very sort of a ferocious way. Not exactly ferocious, but very blunt way. The Bhagavatam is sometimes giving very blunt instructions about what we have to do and how we have to live. And in accordance with and following the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada was very uncompromising. And sometimes when he would address his audience saying that anyone who is unfaithful or un-Vaishnava is operating in a form of insanity. And he gave the example of a person who was arrested and condemned to be executed, to experience capital punishment. And his plea was that he caught the insanity plea. He said that he was insane at the time, that his mind wasn't in proper order when he committed this so-called crime. And so the judge of the case called the civil surgeon into the courtroom to give his a professional opinion. Was the man actually insane and not responsible for his actions, or was he doing it intentionally? Was it a very premeditated act? The civil servant then said, and this is this actually happened. I don't know where and when exactly it happened, but it's an incident that is narrated. He said that he had examined hundreds and thousands of different people to determine whether they were of sound body and mind. And his opinion was that everyone is more or less, he said, more or less insane. And Prabhupada went on to say, when he narrated this story, that anyone who is not Krishna conscious is in some degree mad. Because to think that we should enjoy this material body right up until the end of life is mad. And he once told us another incident that happened. It was when Akbar was the king of India. This was maybe about 400 years ago or less than that. But one of his trusted ministers was by his side. And Akbar asked him, he said, "Well, I'm curious." He said, "How long does this desire, this sexual impetus or desire, exist in the mind of a human being, of a man?" And the minister told him, "Well, it exists right up until the time of death." And at that time, King Akbar thought this was just fantasy, just impossible. So sometime later, years later, they went. The minister said, "I want you to come with me. I want to tell you something. I want you to see something very important." And he said, "And also bring your very young and beautiful daughter, the princess, with you." So he complied, and as they were walking, he said, "We're going to the home of a man who is on the brink of death. He's going to die within a few hours. I want you to notice him, what his eyes are doing." So they entered this man's house, and all the time, Akbar watched him, and the man was watching all the time the princess, and not his king, who was they're visiting him. And afterwards, Akbar said to his minister, "Now I understand what you say, that sex desire exists in a man right up until the time of death." So he told that story. And there's an English saying well, I don't know if it's an English saying, but I may have made it up. But it goes that blood is thicker than devotion. In other words, Dhritarashtra was more attached to being the king or his sons being the proper inheritors of the kingdom than he was to love Krishna, meaning that his blood relationships were more important to him than the devotion to Krishna, or the love of Krishna, to love Krishna. So these were the characteristics of people in those days, and especially if they were Vaishnavas. It was very difficult to be a Raja Rishi, because a Rishi, by nature, is very kind to everyone. He's on the Uttama Adhikari platform. He's in love with every living entity, the birds, the trees, the insects, the rats, the cats, the dogs. But at the same time, because he has to protect the citizens, sometimes he has to punish criminals or put them in a situation where they can't be threatening. They can't harm other people. And this example is given by King Parikshit when he was the king. He saw a man torturing an animal, and he drew his sword upon the man, and he was getting ready to punish him. So being a Raja Rishi was like Yudhisthira. They were very saintly, and they were loved by all their subjects, and they loved all their subjects. But at the same time, they had to do some unpleasant tasks. They had to punish criminals in order to protect the citizens. The citizenry loved them because they felt always protected from rogues and thieves and people like that. So sometimes, and it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam, that capital punishment is even necessary sometimes. It's generally not looked upon very favorably, but it's necessary, especially if someone commits murder, or if you're attacked with deadly weapons and you strike back and you happen to kill the attacker, then you're not punished. You don't have to undergo capital punishment. So in certain cases, if you're robbed, or your wife is assaulted, or your land is appropriated, capital punishment, according to Manushamrita, could be executed, could be employed. And it was executed by the Raja Rishis, by the great kings, by the saintly kings, because they had to do sometimes unpleasant things. And we read in the Bhagavad Gita that Arjuna was very reluctant to fight because he had his loved ones on the other side. But because it was for Krishna, he did it. He went ahead and did it. He did the seemingly unpleasant things. And if one way of reading the Bhagavad Gita is that Krishna was, his whole demeanor was to make Krishna angry, to make Arjuna angry enough to engage in a war, to become an angry soldier, and to decimate people on the other side. So sometimes it's necessary, although anger is not recommended for Vaishnava to engage in it. Sometimes it is necessary. And there's a term in interfaith circles called clergy abuse, where sometimes people use their position of being a priest or something high up in the church or in the temple, a mullah or a pujari, to abuse people. And that's a form of abuse that's called clergy abuse. And that, unfortunately, sometimes goes on even in Islam. It's a form of, you might say, corruption. But it's not recommended. But on certain occasions, it's necessary to be angry and to kill, as the Bhagavad Gita instructs. That if it's done for Krishna under certain circumstances, then it can be done. So I think this is a good place to stop. And see if there's any comments or questions.
Maharaj, I understand in this context, in this olden days time, and there was Raja Rishis, and they had the ability and the kind of power and the faith of the people to, you know, give the up or down, you know, take people out, but in the Chaitanya Leela, I'm not sure if there's any cases where the Lord instructed anyone to be killed. That was only in Krishna's lila. Like there was a famous one of Jagai and Madhai, how he wanted to kill them, but Nityananda stopped him and said, no, everyone is as fallen as these. If you don't deliver them, then we'll have to kill everyone in Kali Yuga. So I'm wondering if this is applicable now in this state where this Kali Yuga is progressing, everyone's very fallen. Like, if we can still execute these orders of the Bhagavatam now, or if we should follow Lord Chaitanya's.
Well, in very rare instances, one can exhibit anger. I think Prabhupada writes in one of his books that if a person blasphemes a devotee of the Lord, we shouldn't stand by idly, but we should tear out the tongue of the offender. But this is an extreme case. As you were rightly pointing out, Lord Chaitanya was very merciful even to Jagai and Madhai, even though Harinasakur and Nityananda wanted to punish them, and even though they were injured. And even though Lord Chaitanya in the beginning exhibited anger with his chakra that he was going to kill them, he was prevented from doing this. And he was known as the most munificent avatar because he accepted everyone. He only looked at Bhava Grahi Janardana, or the good side of people. And technically, he's not even a lila avatar. He's known as Tri Yuga, not an avatar, the person who appears in lila avatar as in the three yugas of Satya, Treta, and Dwapara in different colors. But if you examine the Mahabharata and the Bhagavatam scrutinizingly, you'll see that there are instances where there's such a thing as a yellow avatar. And I think in the Bhagavatam, Garga Muni, who gives the horoscope of Krishna, refers to a yellow avatar. So it's there. It's a little obscure, but it's there. There's such a thing as a yellow-colored incarnation or avatar, even though Lord Chaitanya is not technically an avatar. He's Krishna himself. But many verses say that he's the most munificent of all the forms of Krishna, because he doesn't exhibit punishment and anger as Krishna did. Krishna killed many demons, but we were very merciful. So in the Kali Yuga, the Astra is the Shastra, as it is said, that if one can reasonably convince someone that they should be Krishna conscious and love Krishna instead of being an angry, demonic person, that is the best way to preach in this age, not the age where there's many ferocious demons who need to be done away with. So I don't know if that's helpful. But I don't know of any incidences where Lord Chaitanya, maybe someone else knows, where he exhibited anger and punished criminals. I don't know of any. Any other comments or questions? Yes?
Maharaj, so Vidura was preaching to Dhritarashtra to leave home because he's had so many diseases and he's living like a household dog. The hands of his nephews who killed all his sons, and his body was falling apart. So eventually he did leave and went to the forest to pass away. So what about in this day and age, devotees who are getting old, they may feel like they want to go to Vrindavan or Mayapur to retire. But then we see Prabhupada's example, at old age when his body was getting old and falling apart, he left Vrindavan and travelled around the world spreading Krishna consciousness. So is it a good thing to think, well, I'll just stay in the West, Prabhupada wanted us who were born in the West to preach to Prabhupada Datta Desh, to a particular place where we were born in, to stay here and preach till death, rather than thinking, well, I'll just come retire and think about my own Krishna consciousness in Vrindavan or Mayapur?
There was an incident that speaks to this somewhat. I don't know when it took place, but it was in around about 1973. Prabhupada was in New York and in Manhattan in the so-called skyscraper building. And someone asked him if he would continue preaching in the West. And Prabhupada said that, "I want to die with my boots on." So it's significant in that it shows that, and it's also something that he talked about in the Nectar of Devotion lectures in Vrindavan and in Calcutta and in Los Angeles, that preaching supersedes going to a holy place. Preaching is more important than other things, than the so-called belly button gazing or becoming an advanced devotee. He even said in those Nectar of Devotion series lectures between November of 1972 and December, I think it was, in 1972, that even if one is on the Ujjama Adhikari platform or Paramahansa, that he comes down to the Majjhima level to preach. And the preaching is really important. And that's kind of what separates ISKCON from similar organizations, that the value of Vaishnava behavior is that the preaching is valued as the highest principle. And as you rightly pointed out, Prabhupada was preaching almost right up until the time of death, because he was showing that it didn't really matter where you were, you just had to try to alleviate the suffering of people who were very materialistic. And that was the most merciful, the best activity to engage in. It's not going to a holy place and that's valuable too, and becoming a pure devotee, that's valuable as well. But by preaching, one can also, that has precedence, preaching, according to what I have learned from Prabhupada. I mean, we're, for example, in this country, there supposedly are more restaurants per capita than in other countries. And being a vegetarian is just a tiny, it's not really the ultimate goal, it's just a sort of tiny baby step. But it enlivens people because it's a form of preaching, just as is the Krishna village here is a form of preaching. It's not necessarily the end of everything. That form of yoga isn't bhakti yoga necessarily, but it's a step in the right direction. You wanted to say something?
Remembers along the same lines. We hear often in the Bhagavatam, and going to the forest retirement. How do we translate these direction into modern day life?
I think the way we translate the direction of renunciation of days of yore in the good old days, or the days gone by. That it's the spirit of renunciation that matters. That one can, even in the West, one can live simply. If one isn't attached to the accoutrements of nice cars, nice home, nice surroundings, and adulation. But if one is in the spirit of preaching, in the spirit of renunciation, although it's not living in the forest, not going to a holy place, and living by a sacred river or in a cave, it's one can achieve the same thing by mentally renouncing all and preaching. Preaching is mentally renouncing the good things and so-called good things in life. They're not the same way they were back in the day, where people could go to the forest and that was respected. But it's not so much respected here. There's people that live next to the land, but they more or less live in sheds, and they don't bathe, and they live a kind of, it's not respected because they tend to be kind of scruffy, and to use a vernacular term. But if the spirit of renunciation is there, then one can live in the West, and one can live in good surroundings. That's the idea. That's how it translates anyway, from my perspective. Anything else? Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Chalani
Makhani Maharaj Ki
Jai.
I think this thing needs a battery or something.
Yes.